Shalom and good evening from Yerushalayim. As Rav Kolo accomplished to mention, today we're going to focus on the story of the Megillah, and we'll try to put it in historical perspective and an archaeological perspective, as we usually do in our Shiurim, and to show what we saw, any archaeological evidence that we're aware of that can help understand the Megillah or can help us touch some of the stuff that was around in the days of the Megillah. The story of the Megillah takes place, the exact year is precisely the issue that we're going to try to discuss and pinpoint, but it takes place during a time period of after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, and the Babylonian Empire was captured about 50 years later by the Persians. The king was Cyrus Koresh, and Koresh permitted the Jews to go back and build the second Beis HaMikdash, and then afterwards the story of Purim happened. Now, we're trying to touch on the historical perspectives. This is one of the most complicated issues. This Persian period, as we'll see, is one of the most complex stories. But we're going to start with Golas Babel a little, so we can see, get the background information. First of all, source number two, which you have, my number two, if you can please put up the link, is a chart posted by the Kollel on Daf Yud Aleph base in Megillah. And this is based on the Gemara in Megillah, where the Gemara goes through the whole discussion of Achashverosh's thoughts. Now, the Gemara, we'll sum up the Gemara. We won't go through the whole Gemara inside because that alone will take us half an hour to understand at best. But we'll sum up the Gemara like this. The Gemara says like this. When Yirmiyahu HaNavi, the prophet at the end of the first Beis HaMikdash, was warning the Jews that the Beis HaMikdash will be destroyed and the Jews will go into exile, he used the term of 70 years. But the process of the end of the first Beis HaMikdash was a gradual one. It didn't all just happen in one day. So the Gemara says like this. Nebuchadnezzar became king, and the first year he defeated Nineveh, which means he crushed the Assyrian Empire, and the second year he captured Jehoiakim. He captured King Jehoiakim, he defeated him, and Jehoiakim remained king, but he was to be loyal to Nebuchadnezzar. That was probably meant paying taxes or sending in presents or etc. every year. Jehoiakim did so for 3 years, and then 3 years he rebelled against him. And Nebuchadnezzar naturally was not happy, and after 3 years Nebuchadnezzar came. And this story, by the way, is found briefly in the beginning of Sefer Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar comes to Yerushalayim, and he lays siege, and he takes some of the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, and he brings it to Babel, and
Hello? Is the sound coming in?
Why is there no sound?
Hello? Now it is coming in. Okay. Sound, okay.
Okay.
It just took a minute or so. Right.
Okay. Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar defeats Jehoiakim, and he takes him captive, and Jehoiakim dies on the way to Babel, and he appoints his son, Yechoniah, he appoints him king. Yechoniah doesn't last for too long. 3 months later, Nebuchadnezzar comes again and takes Yechoniah and a bunch of kelim from the Beis HaMikdash and brings him to Babel. He appoints a new king, and this king is named Chittiyahu, and he's king for 11 years also. He swears a loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar, but after a while he decides to side with the Egyptian king, and 9 years later, Nebuchadnezzar comes, starts a war, and 11 years later the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and the Jews go into Golas Babel. The remaining Jews go into Babel, and they're there for 70 years. Before we start, we will go to a few links just to show a little what we know. First of all, if you go to link number 4, you will find a map of what the city of Babel looked like. Now, Babel, of course, was a country, an empire, but the main city was also called Babel. And link number 4 will take you to a map, which will show you, based on archaeological evidence, what we know of what it looked like. Link number 5 will show you, there may be a little problems with link number 5, but I hope you'll be able to bring it up. Link number 5 is a reconstruction of the gates of the city of Babel. Now, very interestingly, if someone would like to go and see the reconstructed gates, he doesn't have to go to Iraq today. He can go to the Berlin Museum, and it's sitting over there. And that's the gates of the city of Babel. Now, if you're not that close to Berlin, for your convenience, I have link number 6. I apologize for the quality of this, but link number 6 was taken. This picture was taken in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, On your left, you see two reliefs of lions, and on the right there's an inscription, which is a little hard to read from here, but it's an inscription by Nebuchadnezzar, which was on the back of the gates. And where he says, I built this city, and I put its foundations deep in the earth, and I built it high up on a mountain, and I protected the city with all types of beasts and animals, which that's what those reliefs are on the gates, to protect the city. And it's signed by Nebuchadnezzar himself. So, truth of the matter is, there are a lot of foundation stones and stuff like that which carry Nebuchadnezzar's name. So we can actually, in the Israel Museum, there's even one or two, come across Nebuchadnezzar in the period when he the mighty king Nebuchadnezzar ruled all of civilization. That gate, by the way, which I'm talking about, is called the Ishtar Gate, which on the map of which you saw on the map over there, it's at the top of the map. Nebuchadnezzar is king for 45 years, as the Gemara explains, and when he dies, his son Evil-merodach becomes king. But before that, let's go to link number 7. If you can please bring up link number 7, there's a very, very interesting artifact. I think it's important for us to all see it. This tablet over here is called the Babylonian Kingology, and it's the history of Babel from the Nebuchadnezzar's predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, until the 7th, 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar. And let's hear what he has to say. Year 7, let's hear what this tablet has to say. Year 7, month Kislevu. And we'll talk about the months in a minute, but of course Kislevu is the month of Kislev. The king of Akkad moved his army into the Hatti land, and laid siege to the city of Judah. And the king took the city on the second day of the month, Adaru, which is the month of Adar. He appointed it a new king of his liking, took heavy booty from it, and brought it into Babylon. So this tablet, okay, the year is a little problematic here. It mentions year 7, while according to the Tanakh it's year 8. The discrepancy of a year is not really too much of a problem. The way they started, the way they counted the years, there's not much of a problem. But it mentions over here that the king went, He appointed a new king, which means obviously he got rid of the previous king, took heavy booty from it, and brought it into Babylon, which is a description that we know in Tanakh, that is the story, can be found at the end of Sefer Melachim. At the end of Sefer Melachim, the story of Yechoniah, King Yechoniah going into Golus, and Melachim Beis, Perek Chav Daled, and Nebuchadnezzar comes to the city, Pasuk Aleph, Yehoyachin goes out to Babel, and he takes all the treasures of the Beis Hashem and of the king's palace, and he cuts off the golden vessels that Shlomo HaMelech did, and he took a lot of the stuff, he takes it to Yerushalayim, and then he appoints a new king, Tzidkiyahu. So this Babylonian chronology is a fits, matches what we know from Tanakh, that the story of, it doesn't mention Yehoyachin by name, but that is a story that mentioned in Tanakh, that Yehoyachin was taken in the 7th year of Nebuchadnezzar, or the 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar, was taken into Golus. I want to mention a couple of words about the months. It mentions over here, I read the month of Kislamu, which is, as I mentioned, Kislev, and Adaru, which is Adar, and the next part talks about Teves. The next part talks about Teves, and these are the names of months that we are familiar with. So let's go on to another link. Link number 8. Let's go to link number 8. And take a look at this little tablet over here. This tablet photo was taken by yours truly in the British Museum of London. It's a small tablet written in what's called the cuneiform, which was the writing that was used then in Babylon, just as the previous tablet. And this tablet carries on it the names of the months. And lo and behold, they are the months that we're familiar with. With Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, etc., those months appear. So for this, I send you to the Hebrew source page. The Hebrew source page, that's link number 1. You have the Hebrew source page in PDF format. Take a look at section number 6.1, which is the last section, hard stuff in the end. A quote from the Yerushalmi Rosh Hashanah, the Yomar B'Chanina, Shemus Chadashim, Olu B'Yadam Mibavel. The names of the months came to Klal Yisrael, came with them from Babel, which means, in the Tanakh, we have names of the months, we have Yerachziv, Yerachbu, we have certain names, and when Klal Yisrael came back from Babel, they adapted the names of the Babylonian months, and that's the months that we use to this very day, the same month. So these names, which appear in the Megillah, for example, Nisan and Teves and other Sivan, all these names do not appear earlier than Golos Babel. They don't appear in Tanakh earlier because earlier were different names of the months. Today we use the Babylonian names for whatever reason. Interesting, Ramban in Parshas Bo, Chodesh HaLochem, refers to it. But they are Babylonian names and they appear, as we mentioned, on the Babylonian chronology and as we saw before. Okay, Nebuchadnezzar becomes rules for 45 years. And in the end of the story of Sefer Melachim, after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, it mentions Vayihi 37 shana legalut Yehoyachin melech Yehuda b'shnemasar chodesh b'shem chodesh, 37 years that Yehoyachin was in Golus, and add another 8 years that Nebuchadnezzar was king before that. B'shnemasar chodesh b'shem chodesh, on the 27th day of the 12th month, which is Adar, Nasa Avil Meradach melech Bavel b'shnas mochodesh Rosh Yehoyachin melech Yehuda mibeis kele. Avil Meradach, which means the son of Nebuchadnezzar, became king. Meradach, by the way, is the name Marduk, which was a Babylonian god. And Avil Meradach takes Yehoyachin out of jail. And he spoke with him good things. He changed the clothing. He took off his prisoner's uniform. And he ate his meal together with King Avil Meradach. And every day he got his daily meal from the king, and over the king supported him until Yechoniah died. So this is again very interesting, because one of the tablets which was found in Babel is a list of, no, I don't have a link to it, sorry, but one of the tablets which was found in Babel has a list of foods that were to be delivered to the family of Yechoniah. So when it mentions in the Megillah that Mordechai, Asher Aglam Yerushalayim, that Mordechai went into Golos with the Golos of Yechoniah, meaning he went in the early stage, the first stage of Golos, which was by King Yechoniah 11 years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. That he remained in Babel, and that's the story of Mordechai. Now, after Avil Meradach is king 23 years, and his son Belshazzar is king for another 2 years. I'm not going to repeat the whole story with the writing on the wall, the story in Sefer Daniel, when they were drinking from the cave of the Beis HaMikdash. They thought that the 70 years were over, because one pasuk in Yirmiyahu says 70 years from when Babel becomes an empire. So they thought the 70 years were over, and since the Beis HaMikdash was not built, they felt secure that they'll have nothing to fear, and they started celebrating and drinking wine out of the Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, and Belshazzar was killed. A while later, the Persian Empire comes to power. The Persians defeat the Babylonians. It said that the method they used was that they diverted the rivers, the Euphrates River, by dam, and they diverted the waters, and this way they were able to enter the city. The river cuts through the city, as you saw in the diagram before, and this way they were able to enter the city, and they basically captured Babel with no battle whatsoever. There's King Dariavash, and then there's King Koresh. Now Koresh had a change of attitude, and for that go to Hebrew source pages, the Hebrew source page, section 1.1, and it says like this. And it says like this, the Hebrew source page 1:1, according from the beginning of Sefer Ezra. V'shnas achas v'koresh melech paras, in the first year of Koresh, the king of Persia, l'chlod d'var Hashem mipi Yirmiyah, when to the conclusion of the words of Hashem from Yirmiyah, which means the 70 years are up, he'ir Hashem etzruach Koresh melech paras, Hashem gave a spirit in Koresh, and he made a decree, a verbal decree, and by letter. And this is the decree. This is what Koresh has to say to the king of Persia. Hashem gave me all the kingdoms of the earth. And he ordered me to build him a house in Yerushalayim, which is in Judea. Anyone from his people, may Hashem be with him. He should go up to Yerushalayim. He should go up and build the house for Hashem in Yerushalayim. This is a very interesting text, which Bible critics, when they saw it at first, right away they couldn't imagine that such a thing is possible, that a king Koresh, a foreign king, would get up and make such a decree that Hashem in Yerushalayim ordered me to build a house. But lo and behold, archaeology, yes, comes to the rescue. And if you go to source page, into this link number 9, take a look at this beautiful, beautiful cylinder. And this is the cylinder that was written by Koresh. When it says that he sent it out by a letter, it could have been a letter like this, where Koresh has the decree, and I'll even, if I'm able to find the text, I'll tell you even the relevant text, that you can't read it unless you know how to read the cuneiform, but yes, we found the text, and he mentions, I'm going to sum it up, he has a whole list of kings, all the kings in the entire world, from the upper to the lower sea, those are sitting in throne rooms, those who live in others, etc. I returned to these sacred cities on the other side of the Tigris. The sanctuaries, which have been ruined for a long time, the images which used to live therein, and establish them for permanent sanctuaries. So, in other words, this is what Koresh tells the story, and he says that when he captured, when he became king, he restored all the kings to their original places and the temples, and he built the temples properly. So we clearly see that this was a policy of King Koresh. It wasn't specifically for Bnei Yisrael, but of course this matches, you know, the story that that he did for Bnei Yisrael. Another interesting thing with this cylinder, as I read to you, he mentions that the sacred cities on the other side of the Tigris, meaning eastward of the Tigris, those cities he restored. Now what about the cities on the west? Like let's say Yerushalayim. What happened there? I mean, it says in Tanakh that he did. But we know that a short while later, as it says in Sefer Ezra, Koresh changed his mind. And it says in Sefer Ezra that a while later, at first Koresh permitted Bnei Yisrael to come back, and they came back, a whole bunch of people, 40,000 people came, and they and the seventh month came, and they built the Mizbeach, to be Makiv Korbanos, to be Makiv Olos, and from then on they were Makiv Olos, but the Beis HaMikdash was not yet rebuilt. and they gave money to bring Lebanese cedars with the permission of King Koresh. However, the good times were not to last too long. A short while later, in Perek Dalet, we see that those neighboring people, the Tzarei Yehuda, the troublemakers, as you would call it, they heard that Bnei Gola are building the Echol, and they right away came to them. We'll talk about them in a moment. But the bottom line is that all the days of Koresh and all the days of the Yavish, as we sum it up in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Hey, they are looking for ways to stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So in other words, Koresh at first gives permission to build the Beis HaMikdash, but a while later he rescinds the permission. Go to the Hebrew source page, section 1.2, and I have a quote over here from the Medrash in Shir Shirim, Medrash Rabban Shir Shirim, and this is a very interesting quote, and I underline the relevant part. I'm not going to read the whole thing, I just bring the whole thing for your convenience if later you want to use it or whatever. It tells the story like this, that after Koresh gave permission to Bnei Yisrael to go and build the Beis HaMikdash, Yosef Koresh was out by Medina. Koresh the next day went, and he's strolling a little, you know, in the financial district, you know, in downtown Wall Street. We're on Medina Shemimus, and he sees that the country is just desolate. The business, the whole business district is empty. Omar Mati was on Medina Shemimus. He says, why is this city empty? Echanim HaZahavim, where are the goldsmiths? Echanim HaKasafim, where are the money changers? Are the people who work with silver? Omile, they told him, Balaf Atu de Gazat Amat Kol Yudon Yivkun Yivnun Beis Mekdasha? Aren't you the one who made the decree that the Jews can go and build the Beis HaMikdash? Minhan the oven, they have the goldsmiths, Minhan Kasafim, they have the silversmiths, Hadassakon live in the Mikdash. They all left to build the Beis HaMikdash, and that's why there's no one around. He shot at that moment, Gaza Va'amar, he made a gzeri, he made a decree for Amar, the Ovar Pras Ovar, the Lo Ovar Lo Yavar. He made a decree, whoever already made it past the Euphrates towards Eretz Yisrael, okay, fine, let him go. But those who didn't make the path to Euphrates, stop them at the bridges over there, don't let them go. So we see that although he had this policy, and at first he said that he's going to let the Jews build the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, but later he changed his mind as far as people going westward. Maybe people going eastward, he let them build their temples. But the Jews, he took back the permission. What's also interesting is, now go to the next section, 1.3 on the Hebrew source page. I quote it here from Ezra Perek Dalet. It says like this. Vayishmu Tzarei Yehuda v'Binyamin k'bnei Gola banim echol Hashem l'kei Yisrael. The enemies of Bnei Yisrael heard that the Bnei Gola, those coming from Golas, are rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. Vayishmu Zubabel v'Roshei Havos. They came to the people, they said, we want to build with you. And the bottom line is that these people claim that they are worshipping Hashem from the days of King Esarhaddon and the King of Ashur, who brought them there. And they want to join. But instead, as it says, this was only a tactic in order to stall for the Beis HaMikdash, and they used everything possible to stall. And the last pasuk is, Ubamachusa Hashverosh Bukshirs Machuso, Kosvos Sitna al Yoshua Yehuda Bushalayim. And the beginning of the Malchus of Achashverosh, they wrote hatred, and Achashverosh did not let them build the Beis HaMikdash. So who are these people? These people are obviously what are known as the Kusim or the Samaritans. I do have one link to the Samaritans. Link number 11 to the Samaritans. It's a picture of two Samaritans with their Sefer Torah. It could be a problem with the links. There are certain links I made that I later sometimes was able to bring them up, sometimes not. It could be problems with the links, I'm sorry. But the Samaritans live today on Hagri's Inn, and as they claim, they've been worshipping Hashem and been Makav Kavanos, and they, in a way, are Makav Kavanos to this very day. They still bring Korban Pesach to this very day. Now, these people are fighting and trying to stop the Beis HaMikdash, and they cause a lot of trouble. And later on, they have a leader by the name of Sanballat, and we will meet him again later on, who is the top troublemaker for Nehemiah, as we mentioned later on. So this pasuk, one pasuk in Ezra, tells us that the story of Achashverosh takes place at this time period before the second Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. Later on, the Achashverosh's successor will be King Dariavesh, and Dariavesh will rebuild the Beis HaMikdash finally, the second time, and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. We'll be on. Can we bring up some links?
Mm-hmm.
We have link number 16. We have link number 16, which is a model of the second Beis HaMikdash, a beautiful model. It could be that side is a problem. That side, it could be. If you have trouble getting in, it could be that side is a problem. It's a model of the second Beis HaMikdash, not the one that Dariush built, but that Herod built. It's a beautiful thing. If you can't see it now, maybe try it later. So I know there's a couple problems with a few of the links on this side Bible picture gallery. Okay, so our setting takes place in that time frame between when Koresh permits the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt. Then he rescinds it, and then later on, Dariush finally builds it. The difference in these years, according to the Gemara, is 18 years, and the Gemara explains that one pasuk says that the Golas Bavel will last for, that Golas Bavel will last for 70 years from when Bavel becomes an empire, and the other pasuk says it will be 70 years from when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. So the Gemara says there were two stages. The first 70 years were indeed over when Koresh became king and he gave him permission to return, but the final building of the Beis HaMikdash is actually 70 years later. What happens afterwards? The second Beis HaMikdash stands. Take a look at the Hebrew source page 2.2. The Gemara in Yoma says like this. That's Tesham and Aleph in the Hebrew source page. Gemara Yoma, that's Tesham and Aleph. 2.2. To Amar Rabba Bachanam Rabbi Yochanan. My Nechsev, the Pesach says, Yeres Hashem Tosif Yamin, Uznos Hashem Tikterna. Yeres Hashem will add days, and the years of Hashem will be shortened. Yeres Hashem, who are the God-fearing people? That's the first Beis HaMikdash that stood for 410 years, and all there were 12 Kohanim Gedolim throughout that period of 410 years, and the Vilna Gaon is Goresh 12 Kohanim Gedolim, not even 18. However, Shnos Hashem Tikterna, the years of Hashem will be shortened. Talking about the second Beis HaMikdash that stood for 420 years, and there were a total of over 300 Kohanim Gadol. We're going to leave the subject of Kohanim Gadol, but what we see from the Gemara here is that the second Beis HaMikdash stood for 420 years. Now this concept, the second Beis HaMikdash stood for 420 years, is consistent throughout Chazal. There's not one other opinion in Chazal that the second Beis HaMikdash stood for 420 years. So according to Chazal, the order is pretty clear. The story of Achashverosh and the Megillah takes place between when the Jews were permitted to go back to Eretz Yisrael and building the second Beis HaMikdash. Shortly after Achashverosh's reign, Dariush permits to build the second Beis HaMikdash, and it stood for 420 years. If you want to see, if you go to link number 14, you can see, go to link number 14, a little about this palace, which is important for us to know. This palace is called the Persepolis. The Persepolis is a magnificent, ruins of a magnificent palace of the Persian kings, which the relief you see over here, the one sitting on the throne, is none other than King Dariush, or Darius in English, and behind him, the one that's standing with the crack in the relief, that is King Xerxes or Achashverosh. The Persepolis, as I said, is not the palace in Shushan, but the palace in Shushan and this and the Persepolis were built at the same time. And the Persepolis, by the way, was excavated by a university in Chicago and in the museum in Chicago today. They have a lot of artifacts from it. And we'll see a few later on, B'zat Hashem. And the description of the Megillah, in the Megillah of the Persian palace, and the way it's been found excavated matches perfectly, beyond doubt. Let's go, for example, to, let's see, if we can go to source page, link 20, Persepolis in ancient Iran. Take a look, and you click on the drawing on the left, you get an enlarged area over here of this palace in different colors. The turquoise section over there is known as the throne room, the hall of 100 columns. And the throne was actually facing the center. Opposite the entrance, and to the in back is the blue room, which is the treasury, and to the left of that is the black room, which is the harem, which is the Beis Hanoshim mentioned in the Megillah. So in other words, the description of the palace fits perfectly the way it was found in the Persepolis. I'm not sure about the details of the one that was excavated in Shushan, but as I said, they were built at the same time. So, same time can be tricky because this palace could have taken over 100 years and they added wings, etc. But they're from the same time, and it's clear, Victor Miller Zatzal brings in a safer, I can't exactly quote you the source, the archaeologist who dug there says that he couldn't have given a better description of the palace than that which appears in the Megillah. Now keep in mind that this palace was destroyed by Alexander the Great, which means that the one who wrote the Megillah was around in the Persian period. Go to source number 21. Source number 21, this is a model of what the Persepolis would have looked when it was complete, and the same ideal, though it's facing the other direction, and you're looking at it from the other direction, but the same point, what this magnificent palace looked like. So this indeed is the palace of the kings of Persia. So, as we said, the story takes place with the Persian Empire, and the Beis Hamikdash stands for 420 years. How did these 420 years break up into? First of all, go to the Hebrew source page, for example, section 4.1. Okay, so let's get to the basics. The time is running out. If we have time, we'll come back to some of the stuff. But so this is what's important for us is I would go to section 2.1. Sorry, 2.1. What's important for us is that the Gemara says like this. Atani Rabbi Yossi, Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Atani Rabbi Yossi Berebi. Malchus Paras was now by 34 shana. The Malchus Paras, the Persian Empire of the 420 years in sacrifice, I mean, just the Persian Empire was 34 years. Malchus Yovan was now by 180 shana. The Greek Empire lasted for 180 years. The Malchus Hashmonai, 103. Malchus Beis Hardus, also 103. So in other words, it divides up the years of the second Beis Hamikdash. The Persian Empire lasted for 34 years. After that, the Greek Empire, 180 years. After that, the Hasmonaim, 103 years. Beis Hardus, another 103 years. A total, we have 420 years. So what's the problem? The problem is that the historians throughout the ages have totally different way of reckoning the numbers and come out with a totally different figure of what the second Beis Hamikdash stood. Please go to link number 3. I apologize for the quality of this. It's a scan. But take a look at this. This is a list of the way historians view the lineage of the Persian king. And this caused a lot of problems. Because in essence, what they're doing is they're adding another 165 years to the Persian Empire. And according to the historians, the second Beis Hamikdash stood 585 years. We can even mention Josephus, for example, who has a number that the second Beis Hamikdash standing for 630 years. Josephus was not very good with math. His math doesn't always match. But the historians most historians, other than Chazal, accept this chronology. And then they go into a big question, who is the Ahasuerus that is mentioned in the story of the Megillah? But I'll just mention that if you take a look, you'll see Darius the First, from the year 522 BCE to 486 BCE, he is the one who built the second Beis Hamikdash. So all three opinions, 1, 2, 3, are saying that the story of the Megillah takes place when the Beis Hamikdash is already rebuilt. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details why everyone chooses a different Xerxes the First is chosen because some of the things we know in history match what it says in the Megillah. The second king is a king named Artaxerxes, which, according to Josephus, he was the king in the time of the story of the Megillah. And third opinion is, much later even, is that it takes place in the name of King Artaxerxes the Second. Sorry, I don't know how to pronounce these names in English, but these are the way they are written in Tanakh. So the historians are pretty much, we can't say they're all unanimous, but that's how it is. Now let me explain a little of the background why we have a problem in the first place. In ancient times, they never had a consecutive counting, consecutive chronology of the years. The years were counted based on the way when the person became king. So a person became king, that is his first year. Now, they also had another rule, and the king, let's say, becomes king in the month of Kislev. So, that's his first year. But the second year will not begin exactly a year later after he became king. The second year will begin at a certain cutoff date, whether it be Aleph Nisan or it be Aleph Tishrei. So, in other words, when Aleph Nisan will come, or Aleph Tishrei, that already be the second year. He could be king, let's say became king in Adar, the Gemara says, in Nisan it's already a new year. Now why do they have this system? It's very simple. Because when they wrote Shtaros, you look at the star, there's no way of knowing if you say it's in the second year of King so-and-so in the month of Adar. Now, and you have another star that says in the month of Kislev. How are people going to remember when this king became king? Did he become king between Adar and Kislev? And if so, the Star of Adar was written first. Did he become king after Adar? And if so, the Star of Kislev was written first. So it would be very confusing. So therefore, they had a simple system. There's a beginning of the year, a new year, and that's Nisan. And then you know, of course, that the Kislev Star was written before Adar. So that was the system. So this this system, means that they're overlapping years. Because you count the year, the previous king already had this 1 year, and the new king has 1 year. So they're overlapping years. But also, if you find documents with years of a certain king, there's no way of knowing who came first, which king was second, and there's no way of knowing if these kings are the same people or other people. Kings sometimes have two names, kings have three names. Let's say, for example, in the Mitzrayim, you have a king named Paro. Go figure which Paro it was. Every king was named Paro. Go figure which Avimelech was the king of the Plishtim. Every king had that name. Now that was common. Now the Gemara is very interesting. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, and I have this in the Hebrew source, page 3.1, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says that the king Koresh, and the king Daryavish, and the king Artaxerxes are the same person. Because Daryavish is Hashem Malchuso, in other words, every king is called Darius. So there's no it can be very confusing since they had no consecutive way of counting. The first ones who had a consecutive way of counting were the Greeks. By the way, today we count our Shtaros. We mentioned the year of creation, 5,764, but that is not the way it always went. That is relatively new, and that began in the Middle Ages. Until then, it was a different way of counting, and that's known in the Gemara as called Minyan Shtaros, the year of the Shtaros, which the Greeks began approximately in the year 310 or 312 BCE, when Alexander the Great, or shortly before Alexander the Great, became king, around that time, they started consecutive counting. And once they started consecutive counting, most of the issues of history vary at most a year or two, but not much more than that, because we have an idea what we're talking about. But before that, there's a problem. Now this method, as I said, continued. I just found out yesterday that the Yemenites, for example, continue writing the Ksubas and the Gittin with the years of Minyan Shtaros. The same, they mention the year based on which began in the year 310 BCE, and from then on they are still counting. We have changed that system, and we use the year of Bria Sa'olam, the years of creation. Archaeologically speaking, the first time that we come across this is in a shul called Susya in south of Hebron, where it mentions the year of creation and the year of Shemitah. Unfortunately, the year of creation is half wiped out, erased, so we don't have the exact year. So, but we see already that that's when in the Byzantine period, in the 4th, 5th century, that's when it began. Anyway, the Persian period is the most confusing period because all this history is done is pieced together based on archaeological finds without any other written material. And that is the most complicated thing. Archaeology cannot stand on itself. If there's no written material to explain archaeology, cannot. It's the most confusing thing. There are places in South America, we have beautiful archaeology of ancient pyramids from the Indians and the Aztecs, whatever, but to figure out who was what, we don't know because we can't read the writing. Archaeology cannot stand on its own. And the Persian period faces this problem but in this case, it's a major discrepancy, and we're talking over here 165 years. And there's got to be a way to sort it out. 165 years is a big time period. It's not so easy to hide 165 years. Why did I say to hide? I'll explain in a second. But so there is the problem. And I think it's important to know this, because if you read like scientific books or any books about the Beis HaMikdash and the year, they will usually go with the scientific thing and mention to you that the Beis HaMikdash stood for close to 600 years, etc. We're not going to solve the problem here, but we will put in a few insights. I'll mention Rav Shimon Schwab Zatzal, the Rav of the Yekki community in Washington Heights. He years ago wrote an article, a very interesting article, and in which it can be found, I think, in there's two books, Selected Speeches and Selected Writings. It's found over there in one of them. He came along with a very interesting approach. He said, indeed, the historians are correct in their assumption, but Chazal purposely hid the knowledge about these 165 years. For some reason, whatever, there's a secret, and Chazal hid these years for 165 years, tried to hide the knowledge, and that's how the discrepancy came about. A while later, Rav Schwab retracted this idea. It's a very revolutionary idea, but he retracted it. It causes so many problems. It's close to impossible to hide 165 years. I don't think historically the Jewish people can hide 165 years. I don't think it's even possible, even if we try to think about it. It's just impossible. But Rav Schwab retracted that idea. There are a few approaches. I can mention that there was a person, Rabbi Azariah Min HaDumim, who wrote a sefer called Ma'or Einayim, where he claimed that Chazal were wrong, and not only claimed that Chazal were wrong in their approach, but he even claimed that from Psukim we see otherwise. And the Maharal, needless to mention, was not very happy about it, and besides making out the whole book, he takes him to town for this. So he retracts Rabbi Min HaDumim, who wants to accept the scientific chronology over Chazal, and even claims that Chazal didn't read the Pesukim properly, and the Maharal says, I mean, come on, for all the claims that we've heard, I don't think we ever heard that anyone claimed that Chazal didn't know how to read the Pesukim properly. But a lot of ideas, a lot of suggestions have been made to cover this discrepancy between the two of them. I'll mention a very interesting article, which appeared in a booklet called Megadim, which was put out by Machon Herzog, in Gush Etzion, in edition 14, volume 14. It's a very interesting article. There are two articles there. One is by Rabbi Yaakov Meidan, who is the editor of the booklet, and one is by a person, Chaim Chefetz. Now this Chaim Chefetz, basically, he claims two things. One, he claims is that the fact that the historians have accepted the chronology in the Persian history is not 100% accurate. There's a lot of discrepancies in the original sources of the Greeks, and he shows that certain kings are listed twice. Certain kings are listed twice. In other words, he claims that you find the name here and the name there. It's not two different people, but it's the same king. That's it. That's one of his claims. And the second claim, which I think is more important for us, is that the Persian Empire began while the Babylonians were still king. While the Babylonian Empire was still there, the Persians were hand in hand together with the Babylonians. And they controlled part of the Babylonian Empire. That's his theory. And in other words, if you have extra years, the extra years are not after the Beis HaMikdash was built, but the extra years are before the Beis HaMikdash was built. And this way, when the Beis HaMikdash was built, indeed, all there were 34 years until the Beis HaMikdash, until the Persian Empire was defeated by Alexander the Great. This is Chaim Chefetz's approach. And first of all, I could say that if you learn in the Pesukim, it's pretty clear in the Pesukim that we have people like Ezra, Nehemiah, that they were all around at the same time. if anyone takes a scientific approach, then Ezra is a one-time period, Nehemiah is a long time later, and it's totally different people. So they have to say that these names are not the same people. It says Ezra could be a different Ezra. But if you look in the Psukim, it's pretty clear from Tanakh that these are the same people. So it's pretty hard to accept a scientific approach from when we read the Psukim. Chaim Chavetz's approach that the Persian Empire began before, I believe it, I accept it for a couple of reasons. One, as Chaim Chavetz himself says, and I already alluded to that before, it's impossible to hide 165 years in Jewish history. Jewish history knows everything that happened before. We know all the years of the kings. We know everything that happened afterwards. We have the whole Anshei Knesset HaGedola in Pirkei Avos, and after that we have the Zugos. There's no way you can just hide 165 years with nothing to show for it. What happened in Jewish history in those 165 years? We have nothing to show for it. So that's one. I could say archaeologically speaking, and today I spoke to the top expert on coinage in the country. His name is Yaakov Masharer, formerly the curator of the Israel Museum, and he told me straight out, he says, in Yerushalayim, for example, very few Persian coins. He says, no Persian coins, but there were Jewish coins that were minted under Persian rule, but very few. And that was what we'd expect for a period of 200 years. The way the historians say, we don't have much to show for it. So far, there's no Persian archaeological evidence in Yerushalayim. However, if we go a little north to Har Gerizim, where the Samaritans were Makav their Karbonos, and we spoke about them before, there's plenty of Persian courts. Plenty of courts. So the Samaritans had people coming to their Beis HaMikdash, and in Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash is standing for 200 years, and there's no Persian coins to show for it. And the answer is simple. If Chaim Chavetz's approach is correct, those coins that were found from the Persian period in Har Gerizim are from before the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt. In other words, they were right when they were saying that we are worshipping Hashem, we are slaughtering Kabbalahs to Him from Esar Chadam. They are correct. They're not lying. They're telling the truth. They were being Makav Kabbalahs all these years, and that's where all the coins come from. I'll mention another thing, and soon I unfortunately have to stop, but I'll mention another thing is that one of the main figures in Nehemiah is a person named Sanballat. Now, this Sanballat is around at the time of Nehemiah. According to the historians, Nehemiah is a good 100 years before the end of the Persian Empire. So Sanballat should be likewise. But it turns out, from very interesting papyrus found in Egypt, by the story in itself, we don't have time to go into it, it turns out that this Sanballat is around a much later period. And it turns also a very interesting story. We know that Shimon HaTzadik, and I have this on the Hebrew source page, sources 5, 1, 5, 2, 5, 3. Shimon HaTzadik was the remnants of Anshei Knesset HaGedola, and Shimon HaTzadik, the story which is brought up from the Gemara in Yuma in source 5:3, meets Alexander the Great. At the same time that he meets Alexander the Great, Sanballat also meets Alexander the Great, the Samaritans. So again, as I said, time is short to go into the full details, but Sanballat appears much later than he should. So the historians have a little difficulty grappling with this, and they come up with their answer that, okay, we had Sanballat the second, and if we have trouble, we need Sanballat the third, we can find him too, that's no problem, which could be theoretically, but again, archaeologically speaking, by the way, the seal of Sanballat has been found and can be seen today in the Israel Museum, a document which he had signed. Again, the archaeological evidence in this country points that there was no Persian period of 200 years after the Beis HaMikdash was built. So if indeed there was these extra years, then I think Chaim Chavetz is correct that they actually took place before the building of the Beis HaMikdash. The Persian period ruled side by side with the Babylonian Empire. Now, the Babylonians didn't have any coins, so there's no way to compare if the Persian coins are after the Babylonian or together. There's no way to compare because the Babylonians did not have coins. Coins were an invention that began in Greece in the 6th century BCE and slowly made their way, and the Persians were the first ones to mint, for example, coins in Eretz Yisrael. You don't have Babylonian coins. So from there, we can't not get the solution. But as I said, in Yerushalayim, for example, there's not much to show. If there was a Beis HaMikdash for 200 years, we would expect a lot more Persian remnants, a lot more Persian coins, just as we found in Har Gerizim. So clearly, as I say, the the Persian history itself is a question. But regarding Chazal, Chazal are consistent that the second Beis HaMikdash stood for 420 years only, and as I said, the archaeological evidence points to that indeed this is the way it was.